You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 237 is Maya Sharp. She is the daughter of Grammy-winning country singer-songwriter Randy Sharp. She is a session harmony vocalist. You're right now hearing the opening track from her debut album, 1997's Hardly Glamour. The song is I Need This to Be Love. We are celebrating the release of her 10th solo album, Tomboy. We'll talk about the song Counter Intuition from that release, then look back to her 2015 album, The Dash Between the Dates, and talk about the song Phoenix. Then look further back to her third album, 2005's Fine Upstanding Citizen. The song A Home was co-written with her father, Randy Sharp, and was covered by The Chicks, a.k.a. The Dixie Chicks. We'll conclude by listening to the title track from the new record, Tomboy. For more information, see mayasharp.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. And you'll never have to hear advertisements, and you'll get access to my nice notes document that give you the lyrics to the songs, the song breakdowns. Let's get to the interview.
My family's name can't save me now. So turn the key in the ignition.
I will play a little bit from I Need This to Be Love from your debut, Hardly Glamour. We want to get pretty quickly to the new album, but do we want to say something briefly about that journey, you know, where you're at with this new album as compared to way back then, where it sounds like, I don't want to say a standard country song, but like a more, this new one sounds very Joni Mitchell-ish. I guess you had these elements even way back in some of the early stuff. Yeah, any sort of through line before we get into the present stuff?
Well, this is going to be challenging to find the through line, considering that we're talking about my very latest single and going back to literally my very, very first release. This was the first song on the first album. It was back in 1997. My co-writer Mark Addison and I sat down to do like a Thelma and Louise vibe, but what if they were together?
Okay.
So it could be Thelma and Louie. You know, the point was that they were like outlaws that weren't really outlaws, but they found themselves on the run. The style of it, I feel like I still have a lot of that in my writing. Production-wise, Mark had a huge influence on that, and he had a big influence on me, especially for those first two or three albums. So it might have been a little more of a Mark Addison Americana, but I definitely still have that in me.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the recording quality and just everything is smooth, that even though you're sneaking in kind of innovative arrangement tricks and things, it all goes very easy on the ears, even on a first listen, which seems like a nice recipe for sneaking in stuff that might be ideologically more interesting than one would expect given that.
Right.
So yes, let's get to this new one, Tomboy. We're going to hear the title track on it to conclude here, but you picked Counter Intuition. Musically interesting. Yeah, do you want to say anything about it before they hear it? And then we'll talk more in detail.
Well, it's funny, we're kind of hitting on the firsts. So Counter Intuition was first song that I wrote for this album that I knew was for a new album. You know, I write all the time and I don't always know as I'm writing who it's for. I write with other people most often, but this song was written alone. And once I had it, it felt like, okay. And I also started to produce it a little bit. Like I got a couple of the elements down, a couple of the signature themes down. And it was the first song in a batch of about a year's worth of songs that I felt like, this feels like an album. And it feels like this has given me the cues for what this album wants to sound like. So that was really the beginning of the production approach to this album. Lyrically, it's entertaining in that I finally got on the dating apps and everything was going so opposite from what I expected. Like I would float something out there and just think like, this is the coolest thing ever. And nobody would care at all about it. And then like, I'd kind of just be short and kind of blunt. And then that would get attention. It was like, oh, wait a minute. Like all of my intuitions were wrong on the dating app. And I didn't last very long on the dating apps, but it did inspire the song.
I wanna name it, hold it tight. I wanna own it outright, like everything that comes and goes is my decision. You wake up and fly away, 'cause I'm yelling, please stay. Might be time I get to know my counter intuition, my counter intuition. Easy to believe in. Map the way and go another. Want the one and take the other. The new leader of the mission. My counterintuition. Ooh. I want to fill up with emptiness.
So any thought about just this overall choice of ensemble? I had written spitty bass, you know, the guitars, there's a lot of chicks and I assume it's played, the bass is played with the pick. There's a lot of sort of little treble parts to this to make it very textured. Any thought about that choice of ensemble?
Well, this one really is a great example of how I approached each song on the album. I framed this out. I did probably 3 acoustic parts. I did a lot of like percussion just around me. Like I knew that I wanted accents here. I knew that I wanted it to sound like a thwap or a swish or whatever. And I would just kind of create that from whatever I had around. Actually, a friend of mine who sadly just moved out of town left a drum kit here for me to kind of babysit. So I got to kind of play with that a little bit. But also in the start of the production of this song, I kind of found the goal for what I wanted for the whole album, which was I want this thing to be more percussive and more rhythm forward than any of my other albums. Mm-hmm. But I don't want a drum set anywhere on it. It has to be all sounds that are helping you to drive forward, where you feel the motion, but it isn't just a drummer. It's something else. It's a percussion element. It's me hitting the face of the guitar. It's me like thumbing on the bass, but not really a note. It's just kind of a thump. So I got as far as I could with it. And then I sent out those tracks. And by that, I mean, I probably did a good 12 or 15 tracks here before I sent them out to percussion player and also got a bass player here. So that is Will Honaker on the bass. I think you're right. I think he is using a pick.
It says Eric Jarkin on percussion.
Eric did all the percussion in his room because he has like a loft full of things from all over the world. So there's no way that you're going to get the best of him if you have him like haul a car full of that stuff over to your house. So I just let him go and he just does it in his own space, and he's just right in the pocket. We hear things the same way, and he gave me all kinds of great stuff like hubcap and like rattle broom and like coffee bag and all of these sounds that are offering up all of the rhythm that you need, but nothing sounds like a drum set.
And I assume that the reverb is doing a good amount of the work. I had written drums with some affected elements because it seems like, you know, that you can make anything sound spatial and a little cool, you know, that you're tapping on your suitcase or whatever, as long as you have the right reverb.
Yeah, verbs. And also I did a lot of tape echo.
Okay.
I'm applying the tape echo to a lot of things too, which is going to affect the EQ and also just give you more of the motion, right? Like I hit it once, but you're going to hear it four times because of the tape echo. I love that.
All right. So doing all that, but still making it sound warm and, you know, in the living room with you, that seems
hopefully
an interesting trick because, you know, it's easy to enter into 80s land once you start.
You are correct. It is. There is a couple. There's one. Which one was it? It's another song on the record, A Fool in Love Again, where I specifically referenced like Howard Jones.
Mm.
You know, the intro to No One Is to Blame? Gong, gong, key, gong.
Isn't
gong,
it Phil
gong,
Collins key. Adding a bunch of goofy
maybe.
Stuff on that? I believe.
I'm not sure. Maybe.
I believe there was like an earlier version that's just him. And then the popular one is like with some added Phil Collins. Anyway,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Not confused here.
No, he made like four versions. Like as soon as that was a hit, he just kept on adding to it and releasing versions of it. But it's funny. I feel like if you go full frontal 80s, if you're just unapologetic 80s, it'll work. You can't go just a little bit. It's got to be like, I know what I'm doing here. It's full on Howard Jones.
Well, that's not the overall impression that I got from here, especially because, well, I guess it was not terribly unusual in the 80s to hide thicker chords, right? The counter intuition, is that a major seventh that you're living on or something thick?
There's a six. There are like nines and sixes. This is the only song I've ever written where I tune the G string down to an F sharp, and that's how I could make that work. For that song, that's how that riff can work. So there's definitely, it's riddled with sixes and nines. And yes, there's probably a major seven right there on the landing. Yeah.
And while we're talking about the arrangement stuff, yeah. So these fun flugelhorn and trumpet. Yes. Any thought about this section in particular? Yeah, so just that nice da-da-da-da-da-da-da thing, and then, yeah, and you thought about that.
So I'd also done a lot of the foundation on my little OP-1 field synthesizer. It's about the size of your forearm, and it can do anything you could possibly want it to do. Like, maybe it won't mow your lawn or make you dinner, but that's about the only things that it won't do. I had already put in that like, I think I have a Nord patch doing that also. That's more like it's just one of the samples on this. I have the Nord Electro 3. So I had the Nord doing it. I had something on the OP doing it. My first instrument is saxophone. So I do hear horns. I'm always kind of looking for a tasteful place to put horns. I never want to like overdo it, but horns are so underused. I mean, speaking of the 80s, that's the era that inspired me to pursue the saxophone. Like, saxophones were everywhere. Horns were everywhere. So now if I have an opportunity to do that, you know, I'm going to jump on that. And I hired a wonderful trumpet player who's also a photographer, artist, Rod Magaha. He came in and he flugled it up. It was great. So now there's three elements that are doing that, but the flugel is in the foreground.
Okay. And then we play a little bit after that. Yeah, he thought about that transition. That sounds like you have a little xylophone thing, jing, 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 going down while he finishes up his fluttering.
That's either Eric Darkin on a real xylophone, which he did play a couple of times, or that could be the little mini Mellotron that I have right over here. I let myself just kind of get lost in it. So I didn't, I mean, as I was going back to, you know, a symbol like, you know, all of the credits and everything, I definitely looked and saw who played what, and I made sure that all of that was right. But while I was doing it, I just went down all of the rabbit holes.
And sure.
So there might be a little bit of Mellotron. There's a ton of sounds on here that are really hard to recall because I just said like acoustic guitar, xylophone, flugel, organ. And it's like some kind of a mashup on the Mellotron that's really hard to recreate it again. But that's the point. You don't. That's what happened in the moment. And I love it. And I'm just going to roll. I can't overthink it. I did that for way too long. So I let this one just kind of roll out. And I think that's why it's so fun.
So are you taking this somewhere to mix and then standing behind the mixer to make sure that it represents every, or do you do sort of an initial mix and then send that off to somebody who has the same DAW that can start with your settings, or how do you keep control with all these different layers?
So Kyle Dreeden mixed the hell out of this. I always do a rough, like a working mix that I send over there. He actually gave me the option. I could just send him the file and he could start from where I was starting. But with all of the things that I do for the song, that this song has been in my hands since its inception of one line, one idea, and I have carried it through to this point, this is the time where I want to hand it over to somebody else's ears. I don't want to be the one in the mix chair. And I also don't even want the things that I did along the way to necessarily influence whoever is in the mix chair. So I gave him raw, zeroed out files with no effects, except for the tape echo, if I really, really loved what was happening with that. If there was something like a delay or something, or like, this is a part of it, you know, a part of the part, then I would include that in there. But he could hear the working mix. He could hear how I was hearing it. He heard where things were panned. He heard how forward the vocal is and, you know, the relationship to the band and where that hi-hat sound goes. Probably wasn't really a hi-hat. So he knew all that. And then he got to color and paint and do the thing that he does all day long. He's a mix engineer all day long. That's his art. It's not mine. So that was really cool that I got to just be like, here we go. And he was excited. He's like, oh my God, usually I just start with somebody's file and I just kind of have to polish it up and clean it up and all that. And this was, he just really got to paint. Yeah, so that was our plan. And it worked. I went over there a couple times. I didn't hover most of the time, but there were like 2 days where I was the hoverer, but only for like an hour. And just so, you know, the comments could happen fast, like up a couple dB with that. That needs to be warmer. Blah, da, 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 da. And then like so much got accomplished in 1 hour.
I'm not gonna yell and I'm not gonna tell you to care anymore.
Yeah, and he just thought about the overall. I mean, this is very lyrically, it's a pretty melody, let me put it that way. And then you get to this, okay, we're going to have some sort of increased energy with the bridge. Yeah, how's the bridge? What's your philosophy of bridges in general? And how does this one work?
My fundamental philosophy is if a bridge isn't going to offer you something new, a new lyrical perspective, a next instrumental plateau, if you're not going to get something out of this, and it doesn't have to be a higher plateau, it can be like the bridge is where you get more inward and focused on something else, or maybe that's where like the tables turn in the story or whatever. If you don't get something new out of the bridge, there's no reason to have it. I think one of my pet peeves is a bridge that's just there because you thought that you had a template, you know? So I never like start a song or think after the second chorus, oh, what am I going to do for the bridge? It's like, what does this want next? You know, it could be anything.
What is the thing that you've been storing up that you want to just say directly? The rest of it is all, you know, tussling with yourself, and here you're addressing somebody else and being a little mean.
Yes.
That line, to care any more than the not at all you do now. That is,
yes,
syntactically
that felt
challenging.
So good to say, because I totally have somebody in mind. But yeah, so I use the bridge to bring someone else into it, because there wasn't a you up until that point. It was all like me thinking, maybe I better not trust my first instinct. And then the bridge just offered another perspective and hopefully another layer to the story. And then the very end is where you really get a surprise layer. I went round and round on that. Am I going to say this? Is this corny? Is this like all of a sudden this character that you thought was really strong the whole time? Is this weakness or is this vulnerability?
The help me fall in love again.
Yeah. All of this is like, can my counterintuition get me to a place where I can fall in love again? And I ended up like really loving it. Like, it's vulnerability equals strength. I mean, that's what it feels like. Like, I'm just going to admit this. This is really what I want from my counterintuition.
Let me play just the end of the bridge, because we actually get that you're saying rising and then it rises. Yeah, and then I thought about that nice little acoustic guitar break that you've got right after that, in that transition.
Yeah, I think that's a pair of high strung. I used a lot of high strung on this one when I needed that kind of shimmery fairies.
Like, you have a separate guitar that is tuned higher? Or you're, what are you saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
As opposed to a capo?
Right. The high strung is tuned. It's still E-A-D-G-B-E, but it is as if you have made a six string acoustic out of the highest six strings of a 12 string.
Oh, I see.
So half of them are an octave up and the other half are not. So you play all the chords that you played on all of your other guitars, but it has this kind of, well, it is literally the higher octave.
Sure.
And it has more of a shimmer to it. It just has more of a, like, it satisfies a whole other EQ range that your other acoustics won't. A lot of times I use it as like a zipper, like a and it's just kind of ringing up there. And if you put it in a sweet spot in the mix, it somehow drives you forward, even though it's in the higher range. And my productions tend to, I reach a point where I feel like, okay, I think I have all the elements that I need. I'm always low and low mid heavy, and my voice is down there too. And it's like whirly, a tuned down acoustic, another acoustic, you know, a bass, a piano in the lower range. All my synths are kind of in the low, you know, in the lower range. I always reach a point where I'm like, okay, who's going to be up high? Who's going to occupy that? Is it going to be like a little like Mando guitar? Is it going to be a high strung? Is it going to be a synth patch, like a chimey thing or like a xylophone? But high strung is about every third time I ask myself that question at that point in pretty much all of my productions. High strung is the answer. And if you listen for that sound through the record, you'll hear it.
So that is purely a recording. How many acoustics do you have sitting around such that you... Because I have a few, but not, yeah, to the extent, you know, I'm thinking, oh, should I get a baritone guitar just so, you know, I can,
right.
But I haven't even made that jump.
I love a baritone. I mean, that would fit right into where like all of my other sounds are though. Like, there's the whirly and the berry and the, you know, the mellotron, and like, mm-hmm, everybody's kind of in that same area, but I love it. I have three primary acoustics. I have my main guy that is like most of like the foundational initial acoustic. He's the guy I play live. Like, it plays easy and I because I use it so often.
And I'm not a gearhead, but what is the model?
Gibson, he's the Parlor, the 00.
Okay.
So it's a little smaller, but it doesn't sound like it. And the mic I use is the AKG 451, which is usually on higher things like hi-hats and cymbals and stuff, but it crushes on an acoustic guitar. So I've been using that a bunch. I have another guitar. You can't play live. She's super temperamental and amazing and huge. Like the body's huge, no electronics in it, and tuned down a whole step. And so that one has a completely different sound, and she's all over it also. Her name is Fiona, and she's all over the album too. But then when you need the high stuff, like you get a Fiona down and you get a primary down, I don't even have a name for him. And then there's room up there, and high strung, you probably are going to regret asking me about it, because once you look it up and you try it, you're going to want one.
We got to stop for some ads. I chose Function because it's the only health platform that gives you access to the kind of data most people never see and insights to actually take action. This is about health empowerment. It's about getting you more information than you're going to get from your primary care provider. You can test over 160 biomarkers and access multi-region MRI and CT scans. This is a service backed by top health leaders. You might recognize Dr. Mark Hyman, Dr. Andrew Huberman, Dr. Jeremy London. So, for instance, a lot of people have issues with low iron. And the obvious thing is just to take an iron supplement. But this could actually backfire. To be absorbed, transported, and stored properly, iron relies on ferritin and copper. So really, you should get tested for all three. This is just one of many, many insights you can get out of this kind of testing. You can get tested from heart to hormones, toxins, inflammation, and stress. I think as you're nakedly examining yourself, per the name of this podcast, a literal examination, not just of your motivations, your creative choices, but your body, the things going on that will influence your motivations and creative choices, it seems called for. For a slightly more examined life, learn more and join using my link. The first 1,000 people get $100 credit toward their membership. Visit functionhealth.com/nakedly or use gift code nakedly100 at sign up to own your health. Let's get the second song out there. I've spent a lot of time in the first one here. Phoenix from The Dash Between the Dates, 2015. You want to say a little where you're at here? A decade ago, we've got some similar elements. We're going to hear some little, I don't know if it's electronica, but like affected percussion that starts us off. A similar, interesting suit, you know, not just your standard, I'm going to put an acoustic down and invite people to just do some layers here. Say a little about this before we hear it.
The thing that I remember most about this song is where I was in my life when I wrote this song. I was in a publishing deal that I was locked into. The guy at the company who signed me, who's awesome, had left in the middle of my term, and I was in the closest to a writer's block that I think I've ever been in, but it was worse than a writer's block. I called it a writer's shrug because I stopped really caring about it. Like, I just got angry and I tried to tell myself that it didn't matter and I didn't really care and da da da. And then that brought up all these things like, man, I thought that this love of songwriting was just endless and would always, always be there. So I realized that I had taken that for granted. Like, no, maybe it's not always there. You have to pay attention to it. So it was just a dark place. And the only way I got out of it was to write, just to make myself write. I did not feel like writing at all, but I had to write myself out of that hole. The first few things that I wrote from that place were officially terrible. Like, I was like,
they will never see the light of day.
That sucks. They will never see the light of day. I've already probably soaked them in water and then thrown, like, you know, and ripped them up and like, nobody can ever see this. I was just off, but I kept on going and I kept on writing, even though like, it's not for a publisher. It's not like anybody's waiting for this. I don't know if I'm making another album. I don't know what's going on, but I have to write. Writing is where it all started. That's my first love with all of this stuff. It's the writing. So I just kept on going, and then little glimmers of this song started to show up. And it's kind of a song of onomatopoeia. Like, it kind of is about what was going on. I needed the phoenix. I needed to come back from what felt like ashes, you know? So once I hooked onto that idea and it kind of used it as a therapy tool as well, once I finished that song, I knew I had more in me. I was kind of out of that kind of angry place. I was out of that place of needing response and kind of judging my own self-worth based on who was giving me praise or not, or paying attention to me or not. Like, I had to like just leave all of that. I couldn't let that define me in any way. And this song really helped with that. And once I got through it, I could keep on writing. And then it was exciting. And then there was enough for an album again. So that was, it's funny that we're talking about these songs that were the first of those albums. But Phoenix is what got me back on a track to make that album.
She don't look like much, I know, but just a couple of storms ago, she was smooth to the touch, and she could move as the crow flies. It's a resurrection day. Leave me now and you'll never know, but if you stick around you can say that you've seen a phoenix rise. Nobody thought she'd wake up, shake off the ashes.
We didn't really talk about the lyrical approach with the previous song. Let's start with that with this. So the first song, Counterintuition, you say this is, you know, a direct reflection of being on the dating apps. It sounded like somebody who's in a relationship. I'm yelling, please stay, might be, you know, that it, the counterintuition is I'm in a relationship and I'm thinking about basically changing my identity and values to grasp a hold of something that I've been repressing. But no, actually, you're already out of the relationship by the time this song comes along. And likewise with the Phoenix, it doesn't sound like somebody who is having trouble with songwriting. It sounds like somebody who is again, sort of in a bad relationship, down something. So I guess that just says that your approach to lyrics is, even though they're very vivid, that it's still a little indeterminate, which is, yes. How specific are you trying to be in telling a story with your tunes in general?
Well, sometimes very specific. Usually, though, I love that it's open enough for you to apply your own life to it. If you hear another story in there, I love that. I won't ever tell you that you're wrong, you know, because there is no wrong. These two songs both started with the idea, and both of them ended up being the title, The Counterintuition and The Phoenix. Like they started with that from a real place. And then once I had the idea, I could start applying it to still real life things, but things that weren't necessarily happening now. Like Counterintuition does include me talking to somebody that's in the past, even though the song itself got started in the present with, like, these apps are hilarious. Like, I'm like opposite person. Like, what was the Seinfeld where George did all the opposite things? And right. Like, I felt like I might have to try that, because it was like, as soon as, if I was completely me and I was just like informal and as if we're just having a conversation, is like, mwah, mwah, just never happened. But it did happen when I was kind of opposite George, which was weird. Yeah. And Phoenix, once I got started on that, it had to expand past, wow, I got to write myself out of this hole. I didn't want to write about writing. So I wanted to write about that journey of pulling yourself out of the ashes, you know, like, no, it isn't over. And here's why, or here's how, maybe, or here's some proof of past times where it wasn't over where you thought it was. So if it wasn't over then, if that situation could survive when you didn't think it would, maybe this one will too. So it didn't stay in the immediate moment of what initially inspired it. But that's one of my favorite things to do, is to explore an idea, like after it sets sail, like, where can I go with this, you know? And how many like little layers of feelings and stories of my own life. And I've been on the planet a little longer now than in that, you know, first song. So there's a lot of little stories now that can, and a lot of people that can show up in the language.
Even though most of Phoenix is in third person, you do have "Leave Me Now and You'll Never Know," but stick around. So okay. So I'm talking about myself, but even though the rest of, yeah, what is this? Talking about yourself mostly in third person, but not always. And then actually you go back at the end, like, well, if she can do it, there's hope for us. So you sort of bring in first person, but now it's you, as you know, aligning with the audience, beholding the example of yourself, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and the us is like me and the writing, you know, we've always been a pair. Like, we've already been through thick and thin, and like, we're all that we need. And then all of a sudden there's a falling out.
And you personified the writing then as this male background vocal who answers you for us, for us.
Oh, it's funny. I didn't think about Arnold as an answer.
Okay. So that you had left the narrative land. You're just working on the coloring of the arrangement at that point.
Yeah. And I had a chance to use him. Oh my God. I met Arnold McCullough singing on a Bonnie Raitt album, and we were her background vocalists, and he is, oh my God. I mean, you've heard him sing with James Taylor. He sang a lot with Bonnie Raitt. God, there's a bunch of others. Jackson Brown. He's just, you've heard his voice.
And yet you got this gig to be a background vocalist with him. Isn't that?
I know. It was amazing.
Do you do a lot of those background vocalist gigs? Like, or this was a...
Occasionally, yeah. I've had the opportunity to sing on two of her albums. And no, three, because the one that I was on, Souls Alike, in 2005, she had me sing on that too. And she had me play a little saxophone on that. It's amazing. But then he was a pal, and then I just asked him to come and sing on a couple songs. And it's like, that's the guy from all the James Taylor records and all the Bonnie records. And so, yeah, I put him, it's funny, I didn't even think of it as like a call and response. Mm-hmm. I was just like, Arnold McCullough. That's all I'm thinking.
So were you kind of dictating very carefully what he should do, or were you letting him like that call and response thing that he does he just do that? I know this was a while ago. You might not.
Yeah, this is a minute ago, but I remember, I think I had a template there. Like I had sung that part and he came in. I'm sure that he added a part to it though. Like maybe it was just one and he harmonized it. He definitely added ideas and I definitely never pushed back on his ideas. His ideas were wonderful. So yeah, he was only a plus.
Yeah, we didn't really talk with Counterintuition either about your approach to harmony vocals that you have, like the leader of the mission, where you're doing, you know, it sounds like it's a similar aesthetic to when you're adding these crazy percussion or just the fact that you can bring xylophone in for a run.
Yeah.
Right. It's not like there's a xylophone part, which I understand that was the percussionist at his house, but it seems like you have a similar approach that in this song, you know, we've got just, oh, let's put a little piano run in here. Is there piano in the rest of the song? I don't think so.
I would never be able to remember that. You know what? There probably is, but it's like in the lower register. It's just kind of a part of the cornstarch. It doesn't have a feature yet. We probably waited till that one run for that. Yeah, that leader of the mission, that's just an octave of the lead. I love throwing those. I think I do that a couple times on the album to throw in a super high back in the mix, just loud enough to hear it. And you even kind of have to lean in for that just for extra angst. It just, yeah, it adds something and it's easy enough to do. I'm doing it all here in this room. So it's not like I'm on the clock.
Sure.
So if it takes me an hour to warm up to really hit that well, that's okay.
Yeah. And on Phoenix, so that you've seen a Phoenix rise, sounds like maybe you are doubling yourself just in unison there.
Probably.
Or is that just electronic, like somebody, the mixer or something, you know, turned up the chorus effect?
No, I think I'm doubling. Okay. I'm probably doubling. I think that's right around when I discovered the magic of the double. So more and more from that album, which is now 4 albums ago.
Mm-hmm.
Since that album, I have probably done a double or triple on my lead vocal more and more often every album. I really love it. It kind of does that thing that the octave does. It's like, why is there just more power here? Like you haven't really added much. It's just, you know, you haven't added another part. You just kind of thickened it up.
Digging deep in the embers, down, down, where a phoenix hides. Nobody thought she'd.
So it was the second half of the verse that you brought in your lower voice to thicken things up.
Mm-hmm. That was a low harmony, yeah.
Yes, which I guess the low harmonies are less intrusive in a way, that the lead keeps the focus. If you add in the high thing, then you better back it way the hell off.
Right.
Or else it's going to just sound like, you know, a barbershop quartet or, you know, some sort of distracting. But yeah, so that you could, I mean, was that your vocal niche? Why you're singing on Bonnie Raitt albums? Because the alto niche, there's not so many professional background singers that, you know, you get the people that have the really high, but the somebody that can slide in there and do a really nice, smooth under harmony.
That's usually who I am. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, even when I sing with male artists, I tend to be underneath. I love that. That's been probably the last maybe 5 or 6 years too. I hear the low harmonies now first. And nothing against a high harmony, because a well-placed high harmony, it can be the exact thing that you need for that lift up right in that place that like no other instrument can offer there. Like just one sweet, especially like if you save it for the end. I love a high harmony. I'm usually not her though. I'm usually the low harmony.
Sure. For some reason, the one that's coming to mind is the Kyrie eleison down the road that I must travel. Kyrie eleison. That
oh,
redefines it. It makes it this choir,
yeah,
by having that high,
right,
harmony there. It, you know, just makes it a fundamentally different thing than if you just didn't
that's
have
funny.
That on. Such that it's not even the same song if you don't even have the high harmony. Whereas the low harmony,
yeah,
is like, okay, well, that's a recording thing. When you do it live, you don't necessarily. Or do you try to recreate all your studio harmonies when you get the live band?
When I have a band. Yeah, absolutely. The low harmony is really important.
Mm-hmm.
I love how understated it is. I love that you might not even notice it, but you are going to notice it if it's not there. So yeah, on like a Bonnie show, if when I have the opportunity to open for her, it isn't like I'm the low harmony in the band for her, but like I'll come up at the end and sit in. But her show, all those low harmonies are covered by the band. Like there's somebody singing it. You might not even really notice. He just kind of shimmies up to the mic and he gives you a little da 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 da. And it's like, it is important to it that you might not even feel unless it's not there.
All right, we need to talk about the arrangement a little, because this thing that you start and end the song with, this affected electronic percussion I wrote, but what was going on there in layering that we're going to have this nice guitar line, but it's going to stop and you're going to hear the percussion, and then we're going to have it come back. The whole thing sounds fairly dark.
My co-producer, Linda Taylor, is the one who made that happen. She's playing acoustic on it and she programmed the percussion. That's what she heard. Yeah, I got to give her all the credit for that one.
Yeah, well, I noticed the credits that you sent me when you sent me the lyrics to this were Linda plays drum programming, bass, guitars, and keyboards, and you play vocal. So was it really that you didn't even play the main guitar on this? Was there a demo that you had, you did the thing, and then she just muted that out? Or do you remember at this stage what the relationship between your demoing and the actual recording?
Sometimes when I would do like what I think is going to be just a guide track, sometimes everybody falls in love with the guide and that ends up on the album, right? Mm-hmm. This song in particular, though, I had made a guitar vocal. I could have even just made a piano vocal and played it for her. And she framed it out at her studio. And so we started with her acoustic, her percussion. She played the bass on that one. And then we stacked that one. Yeah, it's funny. Of all the songs, this might be like one of the few where all I did was the vocal. Usually I add a Wurlitzer or, a piano, another acoustic, whatever. But the space of this song is a part of the charm. So I think we were very careful not to clutter that up. It wants the space. And as you said earlier, like, the use of the reverbs and the tape echoes and stuff like that's also occupying a lot of the space, and we don't want to get in the way of that.
So that's very different than Counterintuition, where you did all these parts yourself and then you use other people just to firm up and add depth and things. Where here, are you less attached? Obviously, this is the song you picked, so you must feel pretty attached to Phoenix as a production, or does it feel like, oh, this is the one that I turned over to a producer who created the soundscape, and I just, your core songwriting idea obviously is in there in the lyrics and things.
Right.
Yeah. What's your comparative relationship between these two kinds of productions?
Yeah. Well, I chose the song for this because of the writing, because of what I think this song helped me out of. Production wise, I've kind of waxed and waned on like, am I doing it all? Am I sharing it with somebody? Am I handing it over? Up to 2019, when I moved to Nashville from Los Angeles, up to that point, those 7 albums that I made up to that point, I co-produced with Mark Addison. I co-produced with my dad. I handed it over to Don Was. I handed it over to Brad Jones. I co-produced with Linda Taylor. Like, I have enjoyed every one of those experiences. Like, I never had a bad experience when I handed it over or when I was the co-producer. I learned from all of them. They tended to be a response to the last one. Like, okay, I didn't do much of the production on that last one. I want to do more on this one. Or I did so much on the last one. I want to hand it over, So I've kind of played it like that all the way up to this point. When I moved to Nashville, it felt like, okay, I want the reins now. And so my last 3 albums, Mercy Rising, Reckless Thoughts, and this album, Tomboy, I wanted it. I wanted to make all the choices. I wanted to frame it out here. I wanted to make all the calls. And this album, the brand new one, is the most me. I played most of the instruments. It's funny. I'm holding on to the control more, but also more loosely than ever. Like, I'm letting it be raw in some spots. There's some things that younger me would have been obsessed about fixing and lining up and putting perfectly on the grid, that right now, today, I was like, you know what? That sounds human and really cool. I'm going to let it roll. So it's been a journey, but I am appreciating being able to find what the song really is here alone first before I bring anybody in, and then just ask them to kind of follow that plan. And I think on this album, it worked. It worked very well.
Well, let's talk about The Young You. We together picked A Home from A Fine Upstanding Citizen, 2005. I noticed co-written by you and Randy Sharp, your dad.
Yeah.
Is he playing the other guitar? There's dual acoustics throughout this, or are you doing both of those? Do you recall?
He played all the guitars on the original demo that we did that was played for the Chicks. They actually recorded this song and did an incredible version of this song and copped a lot of that, a lot of those parts. They also added some of their own parts that I love.
Sorry, was this version released after the Chicks version, your version, or before? Do you recall?
I'm not remembering. I think I was after. Okay. I think they did it first. Yeah, because I think I stole a couple of their harmony ideas.
Ah, all right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll link to their version. I feel I didn't know to look for one. That I'm
no,
interested
no, that's
to hear
okay.
what they had. But your version sounds great. Let's hear it.
Took the warnings for wisdom from so-called friends quick to advise. Though your touch was telling me otherwise. Somehow I saw you. Just young, I was scared, I was wrong. Not a night goes by, I don't dream, I'm wandering through the home that might have been. I listen to my pride. Dream, I'm wandering through the home.
Yeah, so writing with your dad, had you done that a lot? Has it, was that how you started? What?
Yes.
What was the relation in terms of, I mean, I feel guilty because now I have a daughter who just graduated from college, who is a wonderful singer, and I kept being like, oh, I should like have you do an album and I'll produce it in the basement. And I never did that because it's not like a daily part of my life, and she wasn't, you know, just didn't jump. But this is, yeah, say something about this. The relationship that resulted in a song like this. I didn't even notice sort of across your catalog. Have you written several with him? What's the deal?
We have written a lot of songs. This is the only one that got recorded by an outside artist. There's a few that we've written, though, that I recorded on my earlier albums. To speak to what you just said, though, about, you know, wondering if you should have offered to make her, you know, an album, whatever. One of the things that I think is a part of our success is that he never pushed me. Any advice that he gave was always because I asked. So if she didn't ask for it, then it could have been weird if you tried to say, hey, you know what? I do this thing. You should probably do this thing too. Like, he never, ever said that. He's helpful at every step along the way, but only when I ask. Some of the very first songs I ever wrote were with him. He was my first co-writer, and he is a craftsman. I had a hell of a first co-writer. I was extremely, extremely fortunate to have him. He also knew the value of co-writing, so I did a lot of that early on. Didn't write alone a whole lot, like maybe every 10 songs was alone. Mostly I was writing with other people, but those relationships that I made writing with other people led to my very early first things that started happening that really led to being able to do this thing for a living. You know, my co-writer, Mark Addison, the same one on I Need This to Be Love. We wrote another song that his publisher, I wasn't published. I didn't have a label. I didn't have anything going on, but we were writing songs. I was 23, 24. We're writing songs and his publisher got our song recorded by Cher. And now all of a sudden I have a Cher cut. And then he had played it for Miles Copeland, or she, the publisher, had played it for Miles Copeland, and he didn't hear it for his artist, but he liked the voice, and that led to my record deal. I can trace so many of the first things back to people that I wrote with, and so the kind of emphasis on co-writing ended up being a very helpful thing.
But this was co-writing with the intent of somebody has a connection to somebody that you can send this to, and we're trying to create something that potentially somebody could record, not just, hey, let's get together and co-write a thing, which is kind of what I would be doing.
Well, I mean, that's kind of how we framed it while we were writing it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah, we just want to write something that we both really love. I was just starting my artist thing. So like, maybe it's for me, maybe it's for some other project that Mark was doing, maybe it's to pitch, maybe it's all of those things. I've never been a proprietary artist. I've never thought like, no, this is mine. This is going to be my single. Nobody else can have it. If somebody else wants to record my song, record my song. That's awesome. Give it life. And then I'll put it on my next album. I've never stood in the way of that. So I think it can be dangerous to walk into a writing session like, okay, we're writing because your publisher said that we need this. I've done that. I did the staff writer thing. I did the pitch writer, you know, a brief, like write to the brief. It's never worked for me. Some people can do that and awesome for them. It's never worked for me. I have to like walk in and really just like, okay, I want to feel this thing. I want to love it when we leave. And then we'll talk about where it can go.
So now I'm looking at the narrative of this song and the sort of, you know, the one that got away. So what is that to write with your dad, like, let alone any other person. I mean, if it's about, you know, I can't picture Phoenix with it being so much about the personal struggle, is like, if you had a co-writer on that,
yeah,
what would that even be? I mean, I guess it's once you get an idea out there, like Phoenix is really interesting because Counterintuition, like, that's by itself a really interesting idea. Phoenix sounds like it's going to be a cliche. Oh, Phoenix rising from the ashes, but you just scope it so that, like, oh, there's nothing actually cliche about this. Like, this is very carefully done.
I worked hard on that.
So, and a home, and of course the general theme of love lost or whatever. So it's all about the subtlety and the creation of the poetry. So how are you doing this with another person, or was he mostly involved in the music? Or,
well, it's interesting. I feel like there's two questions here to how much a co-writer can shift where the song heads for you, or how much of yourself you put into it. That is different co-writer to co-writer. It is always going to change it, of course. I don't know one time where I feel like the song I co-wrote with somebody would have been exactly the same if I had written it alone, or the song that I wrote alone would be exactly the same if I wrote it with somebody else. That's always going to be a different animal. But the other side of the question is, what about when it's your dad? Like, how much do you get as nitty gritty about stuff? Do you really talk? I mean, writing sessions can kind of turn into therapy sessions sometimes, or like oversharing mm-hmm. about your actual, like, actual events in your life. Fortunately, we have a very easy hang. Like, he's super cool. We've kind of felt like we've been friends for a long time. Like, first of all, they were really young when they had me. So, like, and I'm an only child. So we have just kind of a tight crew, you know, my mom and my dad and me.
So you were doing the taxes. You were taking up.
Well, eventually, yeah. So, like, if it gets really personal, yeah, there are times where, like, I might flash a look at him like, oh, I don't know if I want to go here, you know, and he'll be like, I understand. I don't want you to go here either, you know, or if he's got something in his past, like, I don't know. Should I know this? I don't want to know this, you know, this song though. And I even hesitate to share this about this song. This is entirely craft forward.
Sure.
Like, we got on an idea. We got on a melody. I think he hit that big sus chord at the top of the chorus, and the melody in the verse was on the low side. So when he hit that great ringing sus to be the first chord of the chorus, I was wrong. I remember saying, not a night goes by. That when he hit that, and that's like, oh my God, that is the top of the chorus. Yes, please. And our melody has to soar there. It's a rangy song. Like, I don't do it live very often because it is like chick's range. They slay it, but it's freaking hard to sing. And then they even go higher. It's amazing.
Well, and that is where you have three-part harmony coming in on that not a night.
Yes.
So was that the chicks did it that way, or was that just sort of always the way? Since it had to soar, you're going to have that Kyrie.
Yes. Yeah,
there.
The Kyrie. Yeah, we did that three-part harmony in the demo. And the demo, the original, before my album, before the chicks, the original demo was a dobro and one acoustic and three vocals. And that's what they heard. And we didn't know that they were making an acoustic album. But fortunately for us, they were. So when they heard that song with all the harmony, they just really liked it. And they did the hell out of it. But it was melody, chord, story, craft forward. This one wasn't, which was fortunate for our situation. A father and a kid are writing a song together. It was fortunate that it was neither one of our personal stories.
Yes,
it's just,
yes,
like, what if we wrote
this? I sure wish I wasn't with your mom. I sure wish.
Yeah, no.
Every day I think about no.
No. And they're still rocking.
Since I was saying earlier how a number of these songs, even these very personal ones like Counterintuition, have a certain amount of ambiguity about them, that seems like that makes it easier for another artist to run with it. Like, that this song is such a clear narrative, and, oh, I can impose my, even if I haven't had this exact experience, like, it's easy to sort of latch on to that emotion of somebody who's feeling this kind of longing, a little more universal than just like a very particular, here's my diary poured into a song.
Right.
Like, who else wants to make that? Nobody wants to make some of my weird songs because Just me.
Okay. So first of all, that's a part of kind of what I'm shooting for. Like, I like when it's a little broad and so you can put your own story into it. I love that. But also, you would be amazed at how universal a personal story turns out to be. I've written stuff where I think it is the weirdest little niche of a niche, and like nobody else could possibly want this, and it's just my little thing that I got to get out, and there's somebody waiting to hear that who thought they were the only one who felt that. So I've been amazed at that. Like, the fact, I mean, Home is the biggest selling song that I've ever been a part of writing. And that is a story, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that any of the chicks went through that. Maybe they did. I didn't actually, that's something I should ask them. I never asked them that. But there's something about that. Like, there's some songs where, like, it could be losing somebody to a relationship loss. It could be a death. There's some where there, it's vague enough where you can kind of put in your own thing. But this one is clearly a relationship. Like, this one is what it is. And still, they must have related to it.
I mean, people feel for Antigone or whatever, but they don't haven't gone through that experience of, should I bury my brother? Like, obviously, the drama is not asking you directly, have you lived through this? If not, you won't even get it. You won't.
Right.
I think this is a great transition to just introducing our last song. So the title track from the new album is Tomboy, which I, in your promo materials, you were saying how you and your co-writer, your producer, were sort of trading photos of how you looked when you were 12 and stories.
Writer.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Say a little bit, because this seems like something that, oh, it seems idiosyncratic. It seems actually the most like a diary of anything we've read, but clearly something that a good portion of the populace will very much relate to. And this would be, I could easily see other artists, you know, who had a similar stage or lifestyle currently or whatever, wanting to express this.
Or just they were that as a child.
Yes, yeah.
There are people coming out of the woodwork, sending me photos, letting me know that they feel that way. If you look at them now, you're like, you were a tomboy? Like, you wouldn't know. Yeah, my co-writer, Emily Kopp, who is an old friend, and we've written a bunch of stuff together. Man, I think we had already started like a text war of who looked more like a boy when we were a kid. And we'd already been like just laughing our asses off about it. And then we got together and it came up again in the conversation, you know, like any co-write starts, how are you? What's going on? And it managed to come up again in the conversation. And I think we both got our phones out and found some old photos of ourselves and started to talk about how we felt back then also, and how awkward it felt, and how kind of other and kind of just outside looking in kind of thing. Like, we both had friends, but we were like in all of the photos of our friends, we're like, which one of these things is not like the others? Like, everybody else was wearing the dress or had all the bracelets on, or also the things that they were interested in. That while I was on the playground with the boys, while I was on the baseball team, my friends were doing something else. They were ice skating and horseback riding and doing other things. So the opening verse of this song is, I'm the only one here not wearing a dress. And that triggered something in the writing of it. Cause I remember walking into so many things, a bar mitzvah, a wedding. And I just feel like, oh, half the room here, if they don't know me, they think I'm a boy. And at that time it bothered me. Now I don't care. It still happens every now and then. We let us immerse in how we felt then. And it was really cool to have somebody there who had that same experience. So we got to share about that, like how we both kind of tried to fit in, like we'd kind of try the dress or try the kind of halfway feminine thing to wear to go to the party. And then that was super awkward. And then we both ended up fighting for what we wanted to wear. I was very fortunate that my parents never pushed me to wear anything that I didn't want to. I had a grandmother who was awesome, but she really wanted a frilly little granddaughter for a minute there. She gave up eventually, but she did. Like, she paid me to wear a dress just long enough so she could take a photo to show her friends. Because otherwise I was just like covered in dirt with, you know, a baseball glove and my tough skin jeans. And anyway, Emily and I are going back to this time where we felt awkward. It slowly became a celebration of the strength that the little versions of us had to just know somehow, with no outside influence or validation or example, really, just know that this is who we are and that we're going to wear the pants and we want our hair short. And no, I don't want to wear any eyeshadow. I'm not doing that. And just knowing, I didn't pierce my ears until really late. And then when I did, it was like one. It's just like that strength and the knowing that young, but not realizing that that was a cool thing at the time. But now, as an older person, looking back and realizing that that little kid was a badass. So the song is trying to be celebrational. I wanted to keep the production very playful. And even though you might hear a little bit of angst in there, hopefully by the end, you'll know that this is a triumph.
Well, if you didn't have that determination, that self-confidence, I don't think we'd be talking about your 10th album. Because nobody requests 10 albums out of anybody. Like you gotta just put it out there. And
you gotta have to do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So thanks so much for chatting. It was really great listening through your catalog, and I think people are gonna like the new album.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope that they do.
Thanks so much to Maya. Wonderful songwriter, sharp mind. If you look at the blog post corresponding with this episode at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, you'll find I have linked to a number of her other songs, to her performing with Bonnie Raitt with Art Garfunkel. She mentioned on here that she had a song covered by Cher, so you could hear that. Hear the Chicks version of A Home that we talked about. And in general, to learn more, go to mayasharp.com. I hope you're subscribed to this podcast, either through the public Nakedly Examined Music feed, or to the ad-free feed through patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. If you enjoy this show, please go leave a nice rating or review. And why not just send the link to this episode to a friend who would enjoy Maya's music? Summer is coming to an end. If you hadn't heard, I am teaching a new online philosophy class on political philosophy that is starting very soon, but there's still room for other students. You can check it out at partiallyexaminedlife.com/class, or I just wrote a Substack about it. Go to marklinsenmeyer.substack.com if you want to get an ongoing, very occasional account of my various activities. I had someone else ask about my new album. All the basic tracks have been recorded, but that is only, of course, the first step. We're going through and fixing and adding additional percussion stuff. I haven't started on the harmony vocals, hoping to do that soon. I still actually have to add my bass parts, so there's plenty left to go. Maybe December it'll be done. We'll see. I hope you are being creative, that you are enjoying, discovering, supporting new music. In whatever way you can, keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.